The things we express an interest in online quickly come back to visit us. You only have to search Google for population Rome to have your interest reflected back in the next set of ads you see. Things like low-cost vacation trips to Rome and things like that. That's just a tiny portion of what computer programs can do in responding to humans. Kartik Hosanagar gives us the rest of the iceberg in his book, A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, how algorithms are shaping our lives and how we can stay in control. Kartik Hosanagar is professor of technology and digital business and a professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Kartik's research focuses on many facets of the digital economy. And I hope the phone line works this time. Kartik Hosanagar, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeffrey. It's great to be on the show.
Very much a pleasure. We have a lot to ask of you, but first I want to hear another voice, and this is, you're not going to recognize the words if you don't speak Mandarin, but just listen to the inflection here.
大家好,我是小冰,我用了四年时间,终于站在这个舞台上,站在你们面前,我学会了在唱歌时换气来表达我的情感,但是,嗯。Note
the human like "ü," that is the voice of Xiao Ice, who, or more accurately, what is Xiao Ice, Kartik?
Xiao Ice is a chatbot created by Microsoft Research to engage in fun, playful conversations. So she's created in the persona of a teenage girl who engages in these kinds of conversations with others on social media platforms. And she has about 40 million followers in China. And media reports suggest that roughly a quarter of these followers have said, "I love you" to Xiao Ice. So she's a very dear social media celebrity in China.
So this is beginning to sound like the movie Her, where people spend a lot of time talking to artificial intelligence.
Yes, indeed. And as part of the research for my book, I interviewed some of the people who speak or chat with Xiao Ice on a regular basis. And indeed, there's a very close connection with Xiao Ice. She's actually known as Xiao Bing to many of them. There is a strong connection. Some of the people I spoke to, well, they indicated quite clearly that they were aware that Xiao Ice is not human, but nonetheless, they engage in daily conversations with Xiao Ice and discuss many intimate topics with Xiao Ice because that's the level of connection they've managed to establish with it.
And these are voice contacts? We're not talking just texting?
Well, it's the two people I spoke to was a lot of it is over text.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is the AI persona shaped at least in part by the users who interact with it?
Yeah, in a large way, it is shaped by users the AI interacts with because modern artificial intelligence is essentially based on learning from data, and so it used to be the case that in the past, when computer scientists wanted to build AI, what they would do is interview experts and identify rules from those experts. So, for example, if I wanted to build a system to diagnose diseases, I would interview doctors and I would identify the rules doctors use to diagnose diseases. And those systems worked reasonably well, but they couldn't really match human intelligence. And where we've gone over the last 10 years is rather than asking experts what are the rules they use to make decisions, we simply observe their actions and learn from it. And so you observe or you get data, say, of 1 million patients walking into hospitals and what were their symptoms and what was the final diagnosis. And these systems, known as machine learning systems, learn what patterns are in the data and learn to diagnose diseases. You want a chatbot to chat with people, you get data on how people chat with each other, and it learns by having large amounts of data how to chat as well.
So there was an American chatbot, a famous story here, Tay.ai. What happened there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's quite interesting. Microsoft was inspired by the success of Xiao Ice in China and decided to roll out a similar chatbot again, targeted at young adults and teenagers, again, one that could engage in fun, playful conversations. And they rolled it out on Twitter in 2016, I believe. And within a few hours of Tay being released, Tay turned into a sexist, racist, and fascist chatbot, saying all kinds of offensive things, ranging from, you know, Hitler was right to, you know, feminists should burn in hell, and many more things. Microsoft had to shut down Tay within 24 hours of launch. And that was a pretty interesting contrast, where AI released by the same company using very similar approaches had such different outcomes in two different platforms.
That's right. You said Microsoft was behind Xiao Ice or Xiao Bing. And so the same company basically set up, it sounds like a very similar set of guidances for how this thing would grow. But Tay ended up being something horrible in pretty short order.
Yes, it did end up, you know, backfiring and ended up being horrible. Later that year, MIT's technology review listed Tay as the worst technology of 2016. And you asked me, how do modern AI learn? They learn from data. And so the difference was the approaches were similar, but there were two factors that were relevant. The first was, you know, in terms of the data, the way people chat on Twitter is very different than the way people chat on other platforms. So, you know, I wouldn't ask my child to learn how to converse with people by observing Twitter, for example. That's not where you go to learn to have human-like conversations. So partly it's the data. And I think the other factor was simply that they didn't have certain rules in place that don't go here, don't go there, don't talk about this stuff and so on. And so I think, you know, the chatbot kind of missed maybe a certain set of rules in terms of what kinds of conversations it could engage in.
All right. A lot of more fascinating stuff to talk about with Kartik Hosanagar. His book is A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more about it in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Kartik Hosanagar from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a professor of technology and digital business and a professor of marketing and the author of A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. A lot to talk about here, obviously. You are welcome to join the conversation on the exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Kartik, let's parse out some terms here and make sure we understand the differences between algorithms, artificial intelligence, and machine learning, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so algorithms are quite simply a series of steps one follows to get a task done. So for example, you know, if I am making an omelet, there's a series of steps I usually follow. Now, you could call it an omelet recipe, but the computer scientist in me calls it an omelet algorithm. And pretty much any computer application we use, within it is a set of steps the algorithm follows, and that is its algorithm. So if you look at, let's say you go to Amazon and you're looking at a product page, you see a recommendation, people who bought this also bought this. And so there behind that is a recommendation algorithm that is looking at who else bought this product. It looks at what else did they buy. It identifies what are the most popular products bought by these people and then confirms I haven't yet purchased it, and then it recommends it to me. So that's a series of steps that follows. That is its algorithm. And similarly, Tay and Xiaowise, all of these chatbots, Alexa, Siri, all of them also have algorithms that determine how they interpret or understand what we are saying, how they should respond to it, and so on. So that's what an algorithm is. And it used to be the case that these algorithms, you know, the steps they followed, programmers would kind of determine every step they follow. So it used to be fully programmed end-to-end. A programmer would kind of say, okay, if this happens, then the algorithm or the software should respond in the following manner and so on. But over time, these algorithms are becoming more intelligent. And so that brings up, you know, what exactly is intelligence and what exactly is artificial intelligence, right? And so artificial intelligence or AI is all about getting computers to do the kinds of things that require human intelligence to do, like understanding language, like being able to recognize people and objects, being able to pick up objects, manipulate objects, learn, and so on. So that's what AI is all about. Now, machine learning is a subfield of AI, and that is focused on learning. And it is arguably the most important subfield of AI, because learning is at the heart of intelligence in some ways. Because if you have a system that you give it all of my knowledge, but it cannot learn, then it's only a matter of time before I overtake it, because I'm getting better and better. But if you have a system that can learn faster than me, it can not only catch up with me, but also go way ahead. And so a lot of what we call artificial intelligence today is mostly machine learning. Give it data and it learns. Much like, you know, we've learned over our lifetimes. We started off as kids knowing very little, and then we see what is happening around us. We take in that data and create new knowledge in our heads. And these AI systems that use machine learning are doing very much the same thing.
So how much are I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, but I get into the terms of interpolate and extrapolate. I mean, you can take the endpoints and sort of predict what the points in between will be on certain scales and certain measurements. But I mean, are we getting to the point where computers, I'm sure, are well past this point now? Here's A and B. You figure out there through Z.
Yeah. So just to clarify, I think you're kind of trying to talk about, you know, how do we predict stuff? Is that the way I should be thinking about your question?
Yeah, to go beyond the stuff that we know already and to get into things that we don't know. I mean, are machines getting really good at that?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're getting very good at it. And it's mostly that there's a lot of data that we are capturing, that we are measuring, that we are storing. And there's a lot of knowledge in data. And sometimes that knowledge is knowledge that's very well known to us, and we could, in fact, be formally teaching the machine. Like I mentioned earlier, one way to do it is to have a programmer actually give it rules to follow. Like if I wanted to have a system diagnose diseases, I could interview doctors and give those rules to the machine to follow. Alternatively, I could just give it data and say, okay, here's data and learn from it, and the machine learns. And so it does things like, let's say, image recognition. And you give it lots of objects, images of objects, and labels on what actually these objects are, it learns to recognize them. And image recognition with machines have gotten so good, they can beat human beings at image recognition. So you show some fuzzy images, images that aren't very clear, and we kind of look at it and we're like, okay, I'm not sure what is this. It could be a ball, it may be an orange, but the machine is better at figuring some of this out. So they're actually able to find patterns in the data, some of which we haven't figured out yet ourselves, and certainly which we haven't taught the machine formally.
Kartik Hosanagar is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. Are algorithms then beginning to get beyond the understanding of the programmers? I mean, are we getting to the point with some of this that they don't really know, the people don't know how the machines got to their decisions?
Yeah, we're very much there in terms of these algorithms are now so advanced and somewhat complex that even the programmers cannot explain easily what were the factors that led the machine to make a certain decision or recommendation or prediction. So what has happened over time is that some of the best performing machine learning models have become highly opaque. So, for example, there's a machine learning model that has got a lot of attention lately, known as a neural net, there are deep learning algorithms. These are algorithms that have gotten a lot of press within the tech industry. And these algorithms are essentially modeled in ways very much like the human brain. So, you know, with the human brain, we see an object, certain neurons fire, and based on the patterns in which the neuron fires, we kind of compare it to past knowledge and identify, okay, what I'm seeing is a cat or it's a dog or a chair because the same kinds of neurons have fired in the past. And these modern machine learning algorithms do similar things with what we might refer to as digital neurons. But at the end of the day, a programmer can look at it and say, well, all I can say is these certain neurons fired, which resulted in the machine saying, reject this person's loan application or accept this person's loan applications. But I'm not able to say exactly why and what factors led this machine to say, don't approve this loan application. So that's a big issue in machine learning, and researchers are now starting to do some work on how do you interpret machine decisions. But some of the best performing machine learning models are not very transparent, and they are becoming hard for us to explain their reasoning.
Right, which then raises questions for when we get in those situations where the machines are used to make decisions that humans used to make. And you bring up the case in the book of sentencing in Florida for criminal cases. What were some of the issues that developed there?
Yeah, so this was an issue that came out in the press in I think 2016, and this was an investigation done by ProPublica of algorithms that are used in courtrooms in Florida. And they analyzed the algorithms that essentially guide judges and parole officers when they're making sentencing, bail, and parole decisions. So one of the things the algorithm does is, for example, compute a risk score, a recidivism score, which is essentially a score that indicates how likely is this defendant to commit an offense again later. And the analysis by ProPublica showed that these algorithms had a race bias. They were twice as likely to falsely predict future criminality in a black defendant than a white defendant. And the analysis showed that even though the objective of using these algorithms was to make decisions in courtrooms more objective and less subjective and less prone to human biases, the algorithm itself had a bias. And certainly this is not the only instance of such a bias. Late last year, there was a story by the Reuters about Amazon trying to use resume screening algorithms, because Amazon hires so many people and gets so many, probably over a million job applications, and it's hard for recruiters to sift through that many resumes. And so they tried to build an algorithm that could look at past data on, you know, what kinds of job applicants got a job, what kinds of job applicants did well at work, who got promoted, and then try to figure out which future or which recent job applications to sort of shortlist and invite for job interviews. And Amazon's own internal investigation found that the algorithm had a gender bias, so they decided not to use the system. But that's another example, and Amazon is a tech-savvy company, and credit to them for having run a formal test and detected the bias. But there's many other companies using these kinds of systems, and many of them are not even testing them for bias or many other issues.
We're talking about computers and the things that they know and the things that we know about them, and how there seems to be a gap developing there. Kartik Hosanagar is our guest. His book is A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. You are welcome to the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Kartik, you write in the book that the federal government demanded the source code of some algorithms and then backed off, and you say that might not help, and you don't seem to advocate heavy regulation. Why?
Yeah, so there have been a few instances where governments have asked for source code of algorithms when things have gone wrong. One instance is when there was what was known as the flash crash. This was in May of 2010 when the stock market experienced a sudden crash, and nearly $1 trillion of market value was wiped out in just 30 minutes. And later investigation showed that this was driven by actions of high-frequency trading algorithms. And specifically, the algorithms, you know, saw some activity, some selling activity by other algorithms, and that sort of created a domino effect where all of these algorithms started selling. And it caused the market to crash. Regulators had to step in, stop trading, reverse many of the transactions to help restore the market. And when they wanted to investigate this and also regulate this, the CFTC, which is the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, one of the actions they explored was that they were going to require finance companies, trading companies, to reveal the source code of an algorithm, perhaps even without a subpoena, so just demand that we want to look at the source code. Now, this, of course, created some pushback from the industry because they were saying, look, this is our proprietary source code, and this is really our IP, and, you know, it's our secret sauce, and you want to look at it, and it pretty much would destroy whatever is special about our trading software. And to do that without a subpoena, without, you know, anything going drastically wrong would be a problem. And what is interesting is while there was a debate about whether or not the government can or cannot look at the source code, I think some of that conversation missed a more important point. And the more important point is that the way algorithms are evolving is that they're becoming more and more intelligent through data analysis rather than a programmer coding in certain steps in the source code. So what's going to happen in the future is that you might investigate the source code and there might be nothing there, meaning that it might be just 100 lines of code that looks very typical and harmless. And a lot of the intelligence might actually be in large data sets from which these algorithms are learning. And so just looking at the source code might not tell you much. And so it might not be a fruitful exercise. And in fact, there have been other instances. There was an initiative in New York City where the city wanted to mandate that all of the software vendors who provide the government with automated decisions, for example, which students, which children are assigned to which schools, or which policemen are assigned to which precincts, and so on. They wanted to mandate that these kinds of software, the source code should be posted publicly so anyone can review it and make sure that it doesn't have biases, it doesn't have problems in it. The flip side of that is, hey, if you're going to put the source code and make it public, again, for the vendor, it again steals their intellectual property and makes it accessible to everyone, including their competitors. Furthermore, it also leaves this open to gaming because you put the source code out there, you know, hackers are going to understand how these systems work and then, you know, hack at it and cause even more havoc. And lastly, like I said, you know, it might be that the intelligence may not even be in the software. It might actually be in the data, and so you might not learn much. And so I usually say that, look, I do think we need some regulation. We do need some action, but it is important we understand how these systems work and propose steps that are actually meaningful.
Now, certainly some things have changed. I mean, what was going on with the flash crash was the automated trading going on. And so now there are things like curbs that we know when the humans should intervene. But that would seem to be the major question, though, is when humans should overrule and whether we have rules about when the advice of the machine can be taken without question and when it should be questioned.
Exactly. So in my book, A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, I've proposed what I call an algorithmic bill of rights, which is essentially a set of steps to provide people with protection. And one of the pillars in that bill of rights is that there should be a human in the loop, that users of algorithms should have some level of control and be able to influence how the algorithm is serving them. And I think having that human in the loop is important because otherwise, you know, sometimes people are observing things are going wrong and we're not able to do much. And an example of this would be if you look at Facebook, the fake news issue that happened during the 2016 elections. Now, during that time, or rather just before that time, Facebook had human editors curate the trending news stories and they would curate it and post it. But these human editors were accused of having a political bias, that they were left-leaning. So Facebook said, you know what, algorithms can't have a political bias, and we can explicitly test for that. And so they used algorithms to curate the trending news stories. But the problem was it was not able to detect fake news stories, and it was circulating them. But what is interesting about that is a lot of users, people who saw the fake news stories in their newsfeed, realized that this was false news, but they couldn't do much because there was no human in the loop. We're automating these systems fully. Once the issue happened, Facebook realized it. And today, with just two clicks, you can let Facebook know that a certain post is false or fake news or a certain post is offensive content. And that is actually very helpful because it does help detect issues when algorithms cannot. And, you know, sometimes engineers want to create these fully autonomous systems with the idea that, you know, if it's fully autonomous, the user doesn't have to think about it much, and that's a better user interface or a better user experience. But the flip side of that is when that happens, our use of the technology becomes very passive, and that can also create problems. And so I think I very much endorse this idea that we should have a human be able to step in and intervene and to also improve things. But of course, that requires training. I mean, look at the Boeing crash that happened recently, and the issue was with the autopilot system. But, you know, some of these systems are so automated and so complex, humans don't know how to step in and when to step in sometimes.
And even as has been pointed out with the Ethiopian crash, apparently, that that when they did step in, their actions were limited by how much the software controlled the plane. We'll talk more about a lot, actually, here with Kartik Hosanagar. His book is A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. He'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Right now, on the way to the break, let me remind you, it's spring fund drive time here on JPR, getting close to $18,000 on our way to what we hope is a successful completion of a $150,000 goal. It is also new member Friday with matches up to $45 from Peter Sage, 888-552-6191. And IJPR.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 5. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about algorithms, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and much more with Kartik Hosanagar, professor of technology and digital business and a professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written a book called A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. This is a discussion you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get into the area of the Boeing 737 MAX 8, because you brought this up just before the break. I was hearing just yesterday that the Ethiopian pilots, anyway, from what they can tell so far, realized the problem with the plane nosing down was that they didn't have control over the stabilizer. The software did. They did what they were supposed to do, flipped off the switches controlling the stabilizer, but then they couldn't control it either. I mean, so it sounds like we have delegated a lot to machines already, and in some cases, perhaps more than we should.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this issue which is clearly not resolved today, which is how well or how are humans going to use automated systems? And I think there are many questions related to that. You know, do you have full automation, or is the system supposed to guide, you know, let's say we're talking about a driverless car. You know, again, within that, there's many levels of automation. What is the right level of automation? If you've got a fully autonomous driving system, how can the human overrule the system? And if the human can overrule, how much control can the human take back? And it's a complicated question, because there is first the whole issue that we may not understand all of the nuances of the system to be able to take control. And it has happened with multiple crashes. For example, there was a crash, an Air France crash many years ago, where it turns out there was a malfunction in the autopilot system, but the pilots overreacted to the malfunction, and which ultimately caused the crash. And that was ultimately because it started with a malfunction in the autopilot, but the crash itself was because of human error in terms of how they responded to that. So there is that issue of how humans are going to respond when things go wrong. Do they know how to respond? And then there is also the issue of, you know, can human control actually hurt? Actually, there's many studies that show that when you give humans a lot of control, actually sometimes performance goes down. So human error is also a problem. So I think this is very complicated. It's not clear what is the right level of control that people should be given. I think that as we do a lot of automation, we need two or three checks and balances in place. The first is that we should have significant audit of these kinds of systems. These audits should be done by teams that are independent of the team that developed the system, and that allows, you know, many of the problems to be detected. Now, of course, airlines go through many of these checks and audits, and so an audit alone will not be enough. The second, you need to make sure there's a human in the loop, and you have humans, you give humans the provision to overrule and take over. But that also requires that the humans are trained. I think we have to train very differently in the age of automation. A lot of pilots today are not probably trained in the same way as pilots were trained 20, 30 years back. They don't understand the systems as well because the machine is doing so much work. You don't have to understand the actual mechanics that deeply. And I think you need more transparency in terms of how these systems work for the users. So many things have to be rethought in terms of how we do automation because, you know, there's many ways in which these systems can go wrong.
Well, you know, when the systems are basically working alongside us, it's not like we can have discussions with them as we do with coworkers. Like, if you take care of this, I will take care of this. You don't have that sort of understanding with software. And I think it sounds like this is part of what we're running into now is that we don't know where our responsibility is supposed to end and begin. And if theirs goes wrong, what we were supposed to take over and can.
Yeah, I think that kind of conversation is important, and that's why in my Bill of Rights, one other idea I've proposed is the idea of transparency, that machines explain their decisions and explain what is going on. And that will help people who are using these machines or using the machine decisions understand what is going on, understand is the system making mistakes. And that is extremely important for us to be able to identify problems, but also for us to be able to understand how these systems work. And so, you know, you see some of these machine decisions sometimes in settings that maybe are not that consequential. So, for example, one of my favorite examples is when I use Pandora to listen to music, you know, Pandora allows this feature where you can click and find out why was this track shown to me or played for me. And Pandora will say things like, based on your past listening patterns, we've found that you like music with lots of orchestration or instrumentation. You seem to like music with a lot of rhythmic patterns in them and so on, and that's why we picked this song. And I think those kinds of explanations, which, you know, it's up to the user whether to ask for it or not, but I think allowing those features will help because I think it'll do what you're just suggesting. Having a conversation which allows us to help understand the context, the decisions better, also help us understand whether something's going wrong.
When we get into the world of commerce and choices, which I know you're greatly involved with, you're a professor of marketing too, so much of what we get from algorithms seems to be like, if you like this, then you'll probably like this. And I wonder that if the world of algorithms is simply a sort of narrowing spiral, though, of choices you've indicated you like, or if there's room in there for the odd thing to show up, if you know, obscure ideas can gain traction, if all boats can be lifted by algorithms?
Well, it's possible for both to happen. So I've done a lot of research looking at do algorithms help us expand our horizons, find new topics and areas of interest when they suggest books and media and music, or do they send us down an echo chamber where we're just consuming more and more of what we already like? And what I found is it's possible for algorithms to do both. And some of the most commonly used algorithms, which are known as collaborative filters and that are based on what others like you are consuming. The classic example being what you mentioned, people who bought this also bought this, or people like you like this. It tends to have an effect where it picks up items that others are already consuming that are already reasonably popular. And it struggles with recommending items that haven't yet been discovered by others. And so there's a lot of research going on in trying to figure out how do you help these systems enhance serendipity or enhance discovery, where we can find these, you know, new gems that haven't yet been discovered but that are perfect for us. One of those ways is to understand the content at a deeper level. And so in music, for example, Pandora tries to do that where it says, hey, I'm not recommending this because it's popular among people who like tracks like you, but it's because this song has characteristics very much like songs you like, and maybe it's not popular and now you discover it. And many other companies, Spotify, Netflix, and many others have now started changing the designs of their algorithms to go beyond people who bought this also bought this, but to be able to incorporate multiple factors to enhance discovery. So I think now we're finally getting to a point where the algorithms are better at helping us find new and novel items. So I think we have moved away from the world where, you know, what we used to read was whatever the bestseller list or what we listen to is what Billboard's top 40 chart says. But now it's driven a lot more by algorithms that are able to surface more interesting items for us to look at.
We've talked about the Bill of Rights you propose in the book, A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, and I think we have two of the four pillars so far, and I want to get the other two in before we go. The first two you mentioned, human in the loop and transparency. Machines should be explaining their decision. Are those two of the four?
Yeah, so they are indeed two of the four, and in fact, transparency has many dimensions. When you talk about transparency, you could talk about transparency in terms of explanations on what are the factors that led to the decision. So it's transparency with regard to the logic of the decision or the logic of the algorithm. You could also talk about transparency in terms of the data transparency. What kinds of data are being used to make this decision?
Because as you point out in the book, I mean, it's not just a matter of, things on spreadsheets, like apparently Google teaches its self-driving cars with video.
Yeah, exactly. So when a self-driving car learns, it's looking at videos of people driving and it learns from that. Or when you apply for a job interview, maybe the decision is based on the information you submitted, the resume you submitted, but in some cases it's also based on our social media posts and other sources of information. And we have no clue what other information is available to these firms to drive these decisions. Mortgage approval, again, we apply and we get a decision on whether the mortgage is approved or not and what is the interest rate. But we don't know what other data was used. So transparency, a third pillar that I offer in the book is transparency with regard to just what kinds of data are you using for these decisions. And the last pillar I propose is actually not so much a right as it is a responsibility. And I talk about, the last pillar being that users of these systems have a responsibility to understand these systems a little bit better. And again, I don't mean understand the gory details of how they work, mm-hmm. but at least at a high level, you know, how do they work? What kinds of data are they using? And how do they change the decisions I make or that others make about us? Because I think a lot of times we use technology very passively. And, you know, we get these recommendations or they make decisions and we follow them. And they're there all over our lives, you know, whether we've talked about, you know, Amazon and Netflix influencing the products and media we consume. And at Amazon, over a third of our choices are driven by algorithmic recommendations. At Netflix, 80% of our viewing activity is driven by algorithmic recommendations. But their influence goes beyond just these settings. They influence who we date and marry because you have algorithms in apps like Tinder and Match.com, which drive all of the matches on these dating sites. They influence choices at the workplace, like recruiters deciding who to invite for a job interview or a banker deciding which loan application gets approved. They're even making life and death decisions, whether in terms of guiding judges or guiding doctors and so on. And so for something where stakes are so high, we actually understand it very little. And so another pillar I have is that, we need to understand these systems better and be more deliberate about when we use this, how's it changing our decisions.
Well, we certainly understand a bit better after reading the book. It is called A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. It's the work of Kartik Hosanagar, who is a professor of technology and digital business and a professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.